ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Ben Johnson, CEO of Groovy, a digital marketing product and service that helps producers, distributors, and exhibitors of entertainment content, such as films, games, TV, and festivals, intelligently reach and engage online audiences. Ben, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's begin with a little bit of background on your career and how you got started with Groovy.
So Groovy started in 2010, and basically we were a film recommendations business in our first 2 years. And basically what we were trying to do was, prior to Facebook's Open Graph and services like Netflix that had inbuilt recommendations, we were trying to build a recommendations technology that would allow us to pinpoint to a studio who the audiences might be for a film, and, you know, potentially give some indication on, you know, how many people they could potentially reach. And then we were planning on using that data to then go back to them with an idea for an advertising campaign. Essentially, what we found out was that there was no funding directly for sort of general projects to do with wider marketing. And basically, we sort of ran into the old studio problem that their budgets are very tightly wrapped around a film. So if you come with a specific film campaign, you know, of course they'll take a look at that. But any sort of wider development, you know, from a consultancy perspective, wasn't really in their remit. So we built an app on Facebook. We started collecting user data. It was very similar to what Flickster had as a service back in 2010. We were trying to take advantage of the fact that Facebook created this new sort of platform. And we basically then started to run out of money. And, you know, fortunately, because of the studio contacts we've made, I think someone sort of within the organizations that we were talking to felt sorry for us, so they gave us a film campaign to kind of try out.
That's good so, luck.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Sort of really from about the end of 2011 onwards, we were doing less and less recommendations work, but more and more film campaign work. So I hopped on a flight, went over to LA, met with, you know, heads of international marketing for Sony Pictures and Disney and a few other major players. And out of that, we came back with quite an interesting product idea, which was this idea of creating a destination page, which, you know, depending on the user's location, would give them the right show times for the film that's being advertised. And yeah, we then ended up becoming the endpoint for pretty much every single Sony, Warner, and Disney campaign from about 2012 to about 2014, which was great. I had a lot of fun developing a lot of interesting campaigns. We did The Hobbit, we did The Amazing Spider-Man, did all kinds of very interesting movies. But the thing that we kept on seeing was, you know, we would be doing these widgets for US, UK markets, but then we'd probably, you know, on the bigger releases, be doing upwards of 24 to another 30 plus territories. Now, we went from Jordan to, you know, France or Argentina through to the Philippines. And what we saw was that, you know, it was really great numbers for the number of users that were coming into tools in the English-speaking markets, but it was very hit or miss as to whether or not we got onto any of the other media plans for any of the other territories that were running. So our widgets would either do incredibly well with huge numbers going through them, literally millions and millions of impressions on a daily basis, you know, lots of people checking out show times and going off to book tickets, which of course, you know, was great information for the studios at the time. But, you know, then in France or, you know, Russia or, you know, depending on if we made it to the media plan, we could have reasonable numbers, or you may as well have been blowing tumbleweeds through the widgets that we built because we weren't getting any traffic. So we suddenly had this aha moment in terms of, we realized that one thing was to control the endpoint destination, but the other thing was to control the traffic that was coming into it. So we made all these suggestions to the studios that we were working with that perhaps it would be a good idea to give us some of the Facebook ad spend and that we could show what was working. Because at that time, we had this really neat little tool within Facebook, which was basically a player that would show you the video and then immediately show you the showtime closest to you within the newsfeed. It was a very native experience that converted extremely well. So we were basically came with the argument, look, understand Facebook advertising, let us advertise this player. It converts really, really well. We wouldn't need to take a major budget off you to actually show this tool in operation, and we could potentially talk to you about bigger budgets down the line. And the feedback that we got from the media agencies wasn't good.
They were, don't touch our pile of money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we met our first media agency, and within a few minutes of conducting the interview with them, we suddenly were marched out of the meeting room. And the slow process of disintermediation began. So we realized that the whole media game is a very, very protected space.
You think?
Yeah. We were incredibly naive from a tech background. I haven't actually realized that unwittingly we had been peeing people off, by way of putting it. So, you know, we continue to go down this line of talking about the media budget and controlling the media budget and figuring out who the audience is and doing target media buys. And, you know, it took us about a year to realize that major media agencies were just not interested in working with us. So we would get a lot of traction in initial meetings, but then we'd ping pong ball around various departments and eventually the conversation would go quiet and we wouldn't be able to get in touch with that person again. But, you know, it did seem to be like I think there was interest in our approach, and perhaps we were being looked at from something that would be interesting to perhaps copy in the future, but there was no real commitment to giving us a chance. And media agency game is a very closed game in terms of, you know, if you're within the industry, you understand the language, you understand the performance indicators that they're benchmarking themselves against. You know, you have those networks where you can make the calls to pull things out. And we were just a bunch of tech guys that had just wandered into, you know, a completely new environment without really understanding the system at all.
Well, you had sort of backed into it. You had come from a different angle, which is why you were so disruptive and probably why you were so successful, but also so threatening.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there was definitely that. I mean, to this day, you know, we describe ourselves as a media tech company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do a lot of our own development for any of the tools that we have in-house because, you know, that's our IP. That's what we want to control. But unless we're throwing advertising at it, and this is a very funny thing about the industry, he who controls the media budget controls everything. So you can have the best tech in the world, the best tracking interface, you know, you name it. But unless you're in control of the advertising budget, you're just a very small or, you know, simple line item within, you know, these bigger global plays.
So you left off at 2014 when you were working with these studios. Did you then pivot beyond that? I mean, are you still working with those same studios in this different capacity? Obviously, you're not controlling the ad spend, but what's the current iteration of your service?
Well, we basically realized that the future of the business was this direction, and we realized that it wasn't very well served because, again, we can see the data that comes in. We can see the audiences that come in and how they interact with these tools. So we had all this great information, and we were, of course, feeding it back to the client, feeding it back to the media agencies that were involved or anyone else that would ask us to involve the project. So that drive never stopped. But, I mean, the major iteration that we made to what we were doing was to just stop going after the whales and to just focus on the smaller fish in the sea. So the considerations that a major studio have and, you know, the sort of budgets they have to tackle problems often surmount a lot of the issues that are faced by someone who's trying to release a film, because they can just throw a budget at things. And they have I would describe a studio more like a big venture fund than a filmmaking company. You know, they're taking bets or risks on projects, and they're operating on a model that out of every 10 films,
right, they're going to have a hit.
Yeah, they'll have one or two hits and it'll carry the rest of the budget. So that's not the case for the many, many independent distribution and production companies that are out there. And what we found was that the method of releasing films in today's film industry is completely, it's completely at odds with the way that a typical audience member would discover an independent film. And so what we ended up doing was stumbling into kind of a bit of a, you know, a nice blue ocean, to,
right,
to coin an old management consultant phrase.
Sorry. Old management consultant here, yes.
Yeah. I'll stay away from the word synergy.
Oh, no, you must work it in.
but we kind of stumbled into an environment which was not terribly well serviced by the large industry players, where obviously the monies were smaller, but the need was absolutely overwhelming. And we took on Kim Foss onto our board, who runs a distributor and small, tiny theater here in Copenhagen, where I live. But it's the major art house cinema in Copenhagen. I think it has about 7 or 8 screens. But they show a really eclectic, diverse range of independent film, and it's a lovely location. And Kim runs a small distribution company that releases a lot of art house and independent international films into the Danish market. And so just talking with him, he was like, you know, okay, you're completely missing a trick here. There are hundreds of distributors and producers across Europe, the US, and Latin America that need this kind of service. So then we just suddenly realized, okay, well, it's time to turn this ad hoc series of tools into a platform. And that's kind of the direction we've been going in ever since.
It's fantastic. It's so smart. I'm curious, have you ever used some of these tools with entertainment companies, not to drive ticket sales, but to drive tune-in?
Yes. So one of our largest clients is Viasat. So we do a lot of campaigns for them in Eastern Europe and in Africa. And the remit for that kind of marketing is, you know, to tune into a channel at a certain time. We've also done work for HBO in the Nordics. In Denmark, actually in the whole of the Nordics, we were kind of content starved until about late 2014. And all of a sudden, you know, we had Love Film and Netflix and HBO all starting within months of each other, and then all of a sudden the whole Nordics had access to pretty much all the American content that was there. But, you know, with those kinds of clients, it's very much a catalog issue and address, not the films. Like, the films are interesting, but they want to make people aware of the range.
Their originals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have the benefit of kind of working across the whole value chain of entertainment. So, you know, we work with producers, we work with distributors, we also work with exhibitors. So we do a lot of work with Odeon in the United Kingdom, which is a big chain owned by AMC. And then we've also started working with Video On Demand and, you know, these new entertainment services like HBO in the Nordics. And there are similarities between what we do, but then the end point, what you want the customer to do and the kinds of feeling that you would like the customer to have about the service, there are nuances. So, for instance, with HBO Go, it's cross-promotion, it's making people aware of the different services that are out there, whereas with films, it's selling movie tickets.
Right, right. I'm curious, you had initially talked about Facebook as the social platform you were working on. Are you still concentrating on Facebook? Are you on all of the social platforms, you know, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube? Where are you practicing?
Everywhere. So, yeah, everywhere. I mean, that's the other sort of thing. You know, because we're not distracted by, you know, all kinds of different advertising channels. It's just entertainment. It's within film, television, or games. They all have very similar marketing collateral. You know, the audiences are engaged with the content because trailers are
engaging.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Extremely entertaining art forms to work with. We realized that we had to be on everything. So, you know, we established all kinds of different partnerships with Twitter, Facebook, Snap, and Instagram.
I'm curious, what's your feeling about Vero?
I'm not sure at the moment. Uh-huh. Well, what do you think about it?
Well, I'm watching it, and, you know, I found it interesting when they did what they did in terms of their launch, but I think the challenge is creating a big enough user base, you know, and if Google had a hard time with their friends, this is going to be equally difficult. However, with everybody's concern about data and security and privacy, I'm curious. I was just, since you're so niche in how you're using it, I was wondering if in any markets that was useful, important. I'm also curious, do you use Pinterest at all?
We do use Pinterest, but for certain types of campaigns. We also use things like VContact, and we're beginning to play around with services like WeChat. But Vero hasn't really made it onto anything that we're doing because we listen to our customers in terms of what they think.
Right, where they are.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, every social platform has a limitation in terms of what can be presented in there in terms of what Groovy needs to build. And what we find is the studios have a real, like, they really want their creative to kind of pop off the page and their movie to be stunning. Yeah, so I haven't really looked into Vero yet. It's been on my to-do list, but the other social networks we're looking at are basically VContact and WeChat.
Right. I'm curious about your views on Snap, the redesign, and its longevity. Or is that not something you can talk about? I don't know.
No, I think Snap's very powerful if it's used in the right way. And I think there's been so much fallout with Facebook over the last 3 months or 2 months, ever since the Cambridge Analytica affair.
That's interesting you would say that, because we monitor social engagement on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, and a lot of the networks here in the States pulled back their posting, which was actually a mistake because the users were still absolutely there despite the hashtag trend about stopping. They were there. And so engagement dropped, not because the users weren't there, but because they really pulled back on their posting. So are you seeing user engagement, user participation drop?
It depends on which age group. And I think that's what we're moving towards in the future, is that there'll be certain social networks that you'll move through during the different phases of your life. I think in my age group, sort of 38 to sort of 50, it's still heavily used. But for instance, I've moved massively back into Twitter. I mean, that was a social network I didn't touch for 2 years, and I'm now all day long.
Yeah, well, me too, but I think POTUS is behind that a certain amount. I would have said it was dying a few years ago, and now it's my, you know, lunchtime moment of outrage.
It's completely underrated and a definite buy from a stock perspective.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Wall Street agrees with you 100%.
Because they definitely have it, you know, okay, you can use it for so many different purposes, but I find it just fantastic for getting information about things that I'm interested in. I mean, the amount of content discovery that you can do on Twitter, which is short, to the point, link-based stuff, is so cool.
Yes. Well, and it's interesting with the algorithm changes, how Facebook has become less that way. I guess it's less useful. It's definitely not as searchable, I think. What about there's a lot of talk about Gen Z moving to messaging, where, you know, it's harder to get access to people and to pump in messages. What are your thoughts around that?
Well, I think that's the reason why Facebook.
WeChat.
Yeah, WeChat and also WhatsApp was on Facebook's list of acquisitions. I think they probably spotted that trend a while back.
Right.
But it is, Facebook will continue to be, you know, a useful tool, but it had this moment where just everybody was on it. And if you look at, you know, tools and patterns and, you know, trends and sort of competition, that only lasts for, you know, a brief moment in time. Eventually.
So you think it's going to MySpace?
No, I think Facebook will always be there. I think, you know, the technology itself is robust. I mean, you can still log into Facebook and get distracted by your newsfeed very, very easily. It's just, I choose to use it less because I find that my time on Facebook is for catching up on what my friends or certain groups of my friends are talking about. Whereas if I compare it to my actions on, say, Twitter, it's about what I'm specifically interested in.
Ah, that's really interesting in terms of how it's evolving. The use case that it's evolving to serve is different.
Yeah, and so I think there's plenty of room for Snap to find a niche, and a good niche. My daughter plays with Snap all the time. She hasn't sort of connected up to any friends yet, but she's constantly grabbing my phone and playing around with the lenses.
Right. I just wonder, though, in terms of my Gen Z kids on Snap are very sophisticated in terms of marketing, and they really don't like it. They love it for what they want out of it. They want it for messaging, but they don't want to participate with a third party at all. And so they are very adept at enjoying the features and not participating in those messages that are trying to be filtered to them.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons why we enjoy working with entertainment content so much is because...
Sure, because it's content.
Yes. And it's fun advantage. To market. Yeah, it's fun to market. Even, you know, and trailers are deliberately cut to be as stunning as possible. So it's just a very nice content vertical to work with. It's challenging from a business perspective because, the industry outside of the big six is so fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
But we're living in a time now where there's never been more content acquirers coming into the market. I mean, Apple entered the market last year to start acquiring content. Facebook and, all these different organizations and businesses are going out and reaching out to producer networks to get stuff made. And we're going to be looking at a very different future. I mean, I think cinema and the traditional film distribution will be still there in the future, but it won't be every film has to go through a theatrical release to get any chance of getting daylight. I think there'll be so many different new and interesting platforms to release onto.
Well, I think you're already seeing some of that happening. And also the quality actors are it used to be, if you're on television, you weren't quite as good. And now it's, you can tell longer, deeper, richer stories, multi-part series, and people are enjoying that. Do you also do the creative, or do you advise on the creative, the strategy around that, or do people come to you with that creative input?
Yeah, absolutely. Because the creative, particularly on the social platforms, can make such a huge difference to the click-through rate. And if you don't get the creative right, your targeting can be brilliant and you can be going after the right group of users. But if it's not engaging them, then you'll get penalized by the algorithm that's monitoring the ad spend. So, still to this day, one of the sort of greatest learning experiences we had back in 2010 was working on the movie Fair Game, which was about the Valerie Plame incident where, she got outed as a CIA agent because her husband had refused to endorse the weapons of mass destruction report that he'd been commissioned to go out and collect. Basically went to some part of Africa and realized that there was, no chance that they could actually produce yellow cake uranium, let alone the Iraqi government coming in and actually buying stuff that didn't exist. So it was an interesting film, but it was more of a TV drama than an actual release.
Film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's one of those fun, interesting, something you watch on Netflix now without batting an eyelid on a Sunday evening. But it wasn't something that was particularly theatrically orientated. And then the cast was Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. And they have a very small social footprint because they're both quite private people.
Right.
So the distributor was really nervous about this film. They'd taken it on. They didn't really know how to do it. And so we it was our first film. We completely, and had no idea about how Facebook ad buy worked or anything like that. But we started targeting terms like Naomi Watts and Sean Penn. It was costing us 1.8 euros or nearly $2 to get someone to click.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so we were getting to the stage where we were literally just about to hand the money, what money we had left, back to the client and just say, I'm sorry, we can't help you here. But then the whole Julian Assange thing blew up in Sweden. And we suddenly thought, hang on, this film is one of the first, or this story is one of the first things that WikiLeaks released. So why don't we just reframe the advertising and put it, in the context of WikiLeaks? And as soon as we did that, the targeting worked brilliantly, and our cost per click into the campaign went down to, about 6 or 7 cents.
Oh, wow. As it should be.
It should be, yeah. But also, the interactions on the page went up, and we suddenly realized, okay, this is how social media works from an advertising perspective. It's a combination of the targeting, it's a combination of the messaging. Yeah, we get that. That's really important. The creative's super important, too. And that just... Yeah, so we do, in short, advise a lot about that kind of stuff. We have two sides of the business. One side is the media planning and execution of media and the construction of everything the potential audience member might see. But the other side is the consultancy work that we do when we look at a film and we look at the audience trends that are out there. And we try and figure out, who the audiences are, what are they made up of in terms of different constituents, the balance between men and women, balance between age groups. And more importantly, then, where are they talking? What are they talking about? And if we get some kind of popular culture meme in place, It really is like looking at, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, so that the more you can latch on to something that's happening within the public sphere that is common knowledge, the better chance your film has of actually breaking through into, you know, being recognized and people remembering when they're going down to the cinema to actually buy a ticket for it.
Right. It's really interesting. We've lately been looking at the sort of developmental evolutionary biology behind why people engage with what they engage with and the neuroscience behind it. It's really, really interesting because ultimately people are people, and tapping into that is kind of, it's fun then when you start looking at it, you know, you're like, oh, it all makes sense now why people are behaving this way. Anyway, we're massively running through our time, and I just wanted to touch on one more thing before we wrapped up. And you had done on your blog a very interesting analysis around social media and predicting the Oscars, and you found that it didn't predict the Oscar wins. However, I'm curious how your social media measurements tied to box office and if you looked at that.
So the key thing is noise and noise to signal ratios. So you can have a famous actress in your independent film from another movie, and what you'll end up is the fans of that other movie coming in to follow the actress in this new venture, even though it might be something completely art house. I think if that's the case, then you have to know the history and you have to deconstruct that information out of the analysis. The key thing that we look at is the interaction rate with the point of purchase. So in the run-up to a film being launched, obviously we're looking at likes, comments, and shares. But shares is the thing that's really the critical in any of the social postings that we're looking at. And a share will include people tagging each other, because a common behavior that we see, particularly within Facebook and Instagram, is when people start tagging each other about films, it really does indicate, hey, let's go and check this out. So that's a really important measure. Whereas video view-through rates and likes and comments tend to be a more weak measure. And you can have a famous star in your post and you'll get tons of awareness, but it'll be for that star. It won't be for the film. The key thing at point of sale, like when showtimes become available for a film, is the interaction rate with the actual data of the showtimes. So people investigating dates, people investigating lists of cinemas, people investigating lists of showtimes data has a very, very strong correlation with box office. So if we're talking to a distributor in the run-up to a film, obviously we share a dashboard with them that gives them access to this data in real time. It's one of the things we realized about the agencies was that, you know, a lot of the reporting was coming in 4 weeks after the fact. And, you know, if you've got 1 or 2 weeks to make a film launch happen, it's that kind of reporting doesn't allow you to be tactical at all in the way that you spend your money. So we built this dashboard, and within that dashboard, it very clearly shows you those audience metrics that are meaningful for the success of the film. So the key thing to look out for is this interaction rate. And the interaction rate is based around the intent to actually physically go and see this. And that's where we get a clearer picture on really what's going on for when the film actually launches. We've had movies that have blown up like that because, you know, Keira Knightley's in a post or something like that. And, you know, those stars have huge fan appeal, but they're not interested in the film, they're just interested in seeing Keira Knightley. So that's how we kind of contravene or combat that swell of information. And I think within the Oscars study, you know, one of the things that might have been drawing away from the buzz versus the critical acclaim and the win, and let's face it, the Oscars is a closed group of people working on a series of nominations, so not reflective of public opinion. I mean, you only need to look at a Rotten Tomatoes score between the differences between audience and critics to see that that's happening all over the place. But the buzz on social media can be interrupted by so many different factors. At the end of the day, it's not a reliable measure. But if there was an intent in there, that would do a better job, I think, of actually measuring an Oscar candidate's success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting stuff. We have run through our time. Thank you so much for sharing with us. I wanted to know, lastly, where can our listeners find you and learn more about you and your services?
Sure. So we are on groovy.tv. And that's our website. It's all the contact details there. There's a bunch of free stuff that we put available on our site. There's a book that is all about the industry and what you can do as an exhibitor or a distributor or a producer within these markets. We've got a bunch of...
And that's Groovy with an I.
Yeah, GRUVI.TV.
Okay. Okay, great.
And then very shortly, we'll be opening up our US office in New York. So Marona, my chief of operations, will be coming over to New York in, I think, around about the 8th of May. And we'll be beginning to open shop there. So very exciting times.
Fantastic. Very exciting. Congratulations on the expansion. That's fantastic news. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. So thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Gabriella.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Ben Johnson. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.